You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Andrew Day.
Hey, Bob.
How are you? What have you been doing today?
Well, I've been talking to you about the Earthling. And
oh,
then
that's right. That's right. I remember you.
And I went on a nice walk in the woods. There were no bears today. I used to tell you whenever I would see a bear, I don't do that anymore. It just happens too commonly now.
Really?
So now I'll just tell you when I don't see a bear in the woods, which are the occasions when I can actually take my dog for a walk there.
Our neighborhood has been overtaken by foxes. This happened during the pandemic. And I don't know if it's related. Like, there were fewer pedestrians around, so they just figured now's our chance. But they're incredibly audacious. Like, I was walking down the sidewalk, and there's this fox walking on the sidewalk directly at me. And I'm thinking, well, surely he will yield the right of way, right? And, like, he just walks directly past me, looks up to me like, what the fuck are you doing here?
Man, no respect.
No respect. And, you know, when I was a boy, foxes treated us with great respect. That's one of the many things changed in this country.
Right.
So, yeah, today we've been working to get out the Non-Zero newsletter. And this is the Non-Zero podcast. And it's kind of a long newsletter. I guess there's a lot of stuff going on. And this is the Earthling Unplugged, where we talk about the contents of the newsletter. And we are going to talk about those. I did want to, before we get to those, which include things like the possibly imminent Iranian retaliation against Israel, and include, you know, Mark Andreessen and a lot of things, techno-optimism. I actually wanted to talk about something that's not in the newsletter, which is O.J. Simpson. Because, you know, he did die. And I was, during the whole trial, I was writing a column for the New Republic, and I got three columns out of the trial. I mean, I was obsessed with the trial.
I didn't know that about you. Interesting.
Well, you got to understand, I mean, O.J. Simpson, I still remember the moment I read, I was sitting at that desk, New York Times, and I see a little item saying O.J. Simpson's been arrested. This was so mind-blowing. He was like, you know, the last person in the world you would expect something like that to happen to.
Was he all American, wholesome? He had this kind of vibe of being wholesome.
Totally. Totally. You know, he went on Johnny Carson and absolutely. He had won the Heisman Trophy at USC. Good looking, well spoken. As Biden would say, clean and articulate.
He was almost the Terminator.
What was he? Was he almost cast as that?
He was in the running to be the Terminator, yeah. And then Schwarzenegger got it.
That would have been a very different role. But so anyway, the funny thing is, it became this big racial thing. But of all the black athletes in America at the time, he was almost one of the last who brought race to mind. You just didn't. He was like a crossover hit, kind of, or something. I don't know how to put it, you know. But the one column I wanted to talk about, because I noticed that Charles Blow in the New York Times wrote a thing explaining why a largely black jury acquitted him, even though it seemed clear to many of us that he had committed the crime. And the funny thing is, I wrote that same column at the time. You know, this is, of course, consistent with one of our cherished values at the Non-Zero Newsletter, cognitive empathy, trying to look at things from other people's point of view. But I remember two of the things I said was, one was, you know, white people just have no idea what the experience of a lot of black people is like in the country. And a good example had been, I think, not that long ago at that point, and I brought it up. It was the Rodney King thing. Does that name ring a bell? Do you remember Rodney King? So he's the guy. This was at the dawn of the age of like camcorders. Okay. Cops weren't used to their behavior being chronicled by people with camcorders. This is long before smartphones. And somebody, you know, they had pulled this guy Rodney King over And they say he was out of control. He may have actually been on PCP. I don't know. But they just beat the shit out of him long after they had him subdued. And it was shocking. And one thing I said in this column was, you know, white people like me are like shocked that the LA police behave like this. But pretty much every black person in LA has long heard that LA police behave like this, you know. And that's just an example of why you might, going into this, if you were from a background different from mine, ethnically and socioeconomically, be more suspicious of the police. And then there was a specific reason for suspicion in the O.J. Simpson case that you don't hear that much about. And I later heard an innocent explanation of it, but if you're on this jury, it's going to seem like a red flag. And here is what happened. There was a detective named Van Adder, I think. This is how much attention I paid to it. Not to be confused with Detective Mark Furman.
Yeah, that's the detective guy who became a Fox News talking head.
He also was found to be using the N-word, like, at the time. Maybe it was in one of his, I don't know, that he had used it or something, but that became a thing. He was one of the cops who testified, I think. But this guy, Van Adder, who was a more like upstanding guy and a veteran cop, he had taken the blood sample from O.J. Simpson after they brought him in. Okay. After he's arrested, they take a blood sample. What you're supposed to do at that point is book it at the police department. That's where you are. And you're supposed to leave it there. He put it in his car and brought it to the crime scene. And you know what? They later found evidence of O.J. Simpson's blood at the crime scene. Hell of, you know, now, if you're on the jury and you're inclined to be suspicious, that's pretty weird.
Right.
That is totally in violation of protocol. Okay. Now, I later, there's a guy that I knew who was a public defender. In fact, I happened to just run into him a couple of days ago. I was walking the dog, hadn't seen him in years. He pulls over and we talk. His name is Jerry. I think his last name is Boswell. But he explained to me, I don't know, about 7-8 years ago. And he himself is like a lefty. He's not looking to get cops off the hook. But when I brought that up, he said, oh, yeah, well, the way that works is, like, when there's a celebrity case, okay, the crime scene is crawling with TV cameras. Your average cop wants to get there. It's where the action is. And it can take a long time for bureaucratic reasons to book evidence. So he says it's like it's not that uncommon that a cop would do something like that. So maybe that's why it was. But it's still, I mean, the reasonable doubt standard, you know, that like that fact alone, if I was on the jury, that would move me somewhat in the direction of thinking there's reasonable doubt here. You know, it just seems super weird.
Yeah, I had heard that there was tampering or possible tampering with the crime scene. I wasn't sure of the details. And then the Rodney King connection you're making isn't just that the jury saw this as like payback for Rodney King, but that they had like a rational suspicion about the LAPD.
Yeah, my point was that it may seem strange to us to, you know, upscale white people, that you would go into a trial on a jury prepared to be suspicious of whatever the police say. But then again, people like us didn't realize that the LA cops were beating the shit out of them, you know, and these were cops and these were LA cops. That's where it happened. And that's where the O.J. Simpson thing happened. And so I'm just saying, you know, they just had more reason to be suspicious of cops going in than I might have had. In the jury.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think this is like one of my earliest memories. I was like 4 years old when this all happened. I think I was 5 by the time the verdict came out. And yeah, I remember that something big was going on. I remember the adults in my life were, you know, wanting a guilty verdict, although how much I knew what that even meant, I'm not sure. But yeah, I wasn't aware of who O.J. Simpson was or this kind of racial tension surrounding the whole thing. In recent days, I've been looking at videos that show white people and black people reacting to the verdict, and it's pretty striking, the difference in reaction. But
the other thing is, I kind of think the prosecutor's theory of the case was wrong. the idea that he kind of went there to kill her, Nicole.
And not the boy. She had a boyfriend, right?
Right. And the boyfriend, was it Ron Goldman?
Sounds right.
I don't know if he was the boyfriend. They were friends. Maybe he was the boyfriend. O.J. Simpson probably thought he was, but apparently he had been. You know, I think Nicole had, as part of the whatever, the arrangement, Nicole had kept O.J. Simpson's car. This is his divorced, or they were separated or divorced or something. And apparently Ron Goldman had been driving it around town. But I always thought he probably came fundamentally to kill him. I mean, it's a hell of a coincidence if he came to kill her that Ron Goldman happened to have just come onto the porch and O.J. Simpson walked up and killed him, you know, started stabbing him. But this is neither here nor there. Now, were you going to say something else about it? Did I interrupt?
No, I don't have much to say about it. I was only 4 years old, 5 years old when it happened, but that's interesting to hear. So the theory of the case that you disagree with is that he intentionally wanted to kill her. Like, that was the main motivation.
Marcia Clark was the main prosecutor, and that was her theory. That was her, very much her, you know, that it was kind of a crime of misogyny. And look, I mean, he may have planned to kill both of them, and certainly it's not crazy to use the word misogyny when a guy stabs a woman to death. But I always, I don't know what he had in mind when he went there, but I do think he attacked Ron Goldman first. And I think, of course, it was her assistant, the assistant prosecutor, who made the big blunder of asking O.J. Simpson to try on the glove. You've seen that, right?
Yeah, and I've heard theories about his arthritis making his hands get swollen.
I don't think it was even that. I mean, look, if you're wearing gloves to commit to murder, right, your dexterity matters. They're going to be pretty thin and tight-fitting gloves, right? And pliable. Well, then they've got blood all over them. They've been sitting in the evidence room. I would imagine they get kind of stiff and cardboardy, right? So it's if they were tight to begin with, it's not that hard to theatrically act as if you can't quite fit, you know, get them on.
Right.
Which is what he did. And that led to the refrain of the defense attorney, Johnny Cochran. Can you recite it?
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
If the gloves don't fit, you must acquit.
It's pretty catchy. That's a good refrain.
Yeah, it worked.
It did. You want to talk about Israel and Iran?
Yeah, so we are taping this late Friday afternoon, and as of now, there's just been a flurry of stories over the last, it seems like the last 12, 24 hours about imminent retaliation expected. It was 12 days ago that Israel launched the strike on the Iranian diplomatic compound and killed I think three generals, according to Iran. I've seen two elsewhere. But in any event, you know, major, major escalation, both because it's on some kind of diplomatic compound and they're killing these senior commanders. This is just ratcheting it way up. But you found an item that we're featuring in the newsletter, which I guess gives us some hope of there being an off-ramp, right?
Yeah, that's right. And maybe also I'd wanted to say, because there's some other things going on. I mean, these reports that U.S. officials are saying that the attack is imminent are somewhat in conflict with each other. I've seen some reports suggesting that U.S. officials are saying this could be like a massive attack with like 100 drone strikes and dozens of cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. I think more recently, a U.S. official told the media that the U.S. is expecting it to be an attack that's not so big that it leads to the U.S. getting involved in a war with Iran. And that would seem more likely to me. I mean, I feel like Iran does need to respond. Like, from their perspective, it makes sense that they would want to restore deterrence, but I would expect it to be kind of calibrated to avoid a war with the U.S. And the one thing that stuck out to me is that, you know, the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has been talking to his counterpart, the Defense Minister Gallant, and apparently has been telling him two big things. One, apparently Israel didn't notify the U.S. of the embassy strike.
Is that the reporting that they didn't clear it with us?
That's what the Biden administration is saying. And so apparently, Austin was telling Gallant, you know, you should have warned us. And then the second thing is he's saying we'll defend Israel if Iran indeed does attack. And these two things don't really seem to go together.
No, you know? In fact, I tweeted this thing. Might as well fire up Twitter to see if the attack has happened. But what I said was, if Bibi didn't clear the strike with the U.S., why is the U.S. giving him the support? And if Bibi did clear the strike, why did we green light it? There's like no world in which it makes sense for us to step into this thing at this point.
Right.
Because neither of those makes any sense at all as rational U.S. policy, to green light the strike in the first place, or if Israel didn't run it by us, to stand in and help them get out of this mess. That's crazy.
It is crazy. And Biden, you know, he's also been saying that America is devoted to Israel. Our commitment is ironclad. And there's just too many problems with this ironclad commitment at this point. I mean, one, it creates a moral hazard. I don't think Israel would have done this if they doubted that America would come to their defense if necessary. And two, now we have our credibility on the line because our major officials, including our president, are saying we'll defend Israel if Iran attacks. So if Iran does attack, you can imagine them feeling kind of compelled to do something. And I think the third problem with that is Iran sees Israeli belligerence as partly the fault of the United States. And so, I mean, it's kind of amazing to me that if Israel really didn't notify us that they were going to do that, because one obvious possible consequence of it would be for these Iran-backed militias to target U.S. troops who are just sitting ducks in the Middle East. Like, you would think, even if they didn't ask our permission to do this and ask for a green light, they would at least let us know so that we could kind of prepare our troops in the event of retaliation.
Well, I think they knew, though, that if they let us know, we said don't do that, it would be kind of awkward for them to proceed, given the fact that we're supplying their weapons. Now, I do think that all this stuff about an ironclad commitment may be something that the White House feels it needs to say, partly to discourage an overly aggressive retaliation from Iran. In other words, give Iran the idea, whether or not it's true, that you're dealing, you know, with a hair-triggered regional war here. I suspect, now, I mean, I don't doubt that Biden plans, like, if there's a larger war, to support Israel, but we may be doing more than is apparent to calibrate Israel's response to any provocation. You know, we sent this 4-star general over there who's, I guess, in Israel now. And I suspect that one thing he's there to do is to say to, you know, depending on what the retaliation is, if it materializes, to say to Israel under circumstances, no, you can't do X and Y in response to this and expect us to support you. You got yourself into this mess. So it could be that we plan to moderate or even, you know, neutralize the, you know, veto the Israeli response. But we think that, you know, the game theory compels us to say to Iran right now publicly, we'll back them to the hilt. I don't know.
No, I agree with that. I think that messaging is intended to deter. My point is just that there's a flip side of this deterrence, where if the attack happens anyway, I mean, one of the reasons Biden's messages have a deterrent ability is because he's kind of putting our credibility on the line, right? Like, that's kind of the point of publicly messaging in this way. And so the flip side of that is if the deterrence doesn't work, our credibility is on the line. And yeah, I can see this leading to a U.S.-Iran conflict. I'm not predicting that, but it seems like the chances are higher than they've been in a while. And I guess a lot of it depends on, first, whether Iran does attack, which I'm curious if you think they will, and two, how big of an attack it is.
I mean, Iran has always been pretty careful. I mean, what our assassination of Soleimani was a bigger escalation than what Israel did. And Iran was very careful. What they did was they did launch ballistic missiles at the barracks of U.S. soldiers, but they passed the word apparently through people in Iraq to the U.S. that they better vacate those barracks. So it was just a demonstration of their ability to blow up barracks. And it gave some concussions to soldiers who were in a bomb shelter. On the other hand, that was the U.S. I mean, that was, they probably are not quite as reluctant to respond to Israel forcefully, even if they think the U.S. will probably get in. It probably just seems a little different. I mean, as I was telling you, I would think I'd be kind of surprised if the response was on Israeli territory, because that's such a red line, you would think. On the other hand, there aren't that many other options. Trita Parsi, in this piece that we should talk about in a second, of the Quincy Institute, noted there's problems with hitting like any embassies in the region, from Iran's point of view, since they pretty much all belong to countries Iran doesn't want to antagonize. I mean, they're on their territory. I wondered why. I thought maybe what they would do. I mean, I don't know ballistic missile technology. But if they have the capability, if the Israeli troops in Gaza are sufficiently stationary that they could hit them with ballistic missiles, I would think that that's a less escalatory thing than striking military targets in Israel. On the other hand, that involves either flying the missiles over Israel, and I don't know anything about the altitude or whether they could be intercepted by the Patriot systems. And I don't know if ballistic missiles can do these circuitous routes where you take a left at this intersection. I mean, I just can't. Don't know. They can't,
just,
right?
They just they do go a parabolic way up. Arc.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So maybe it's problematic. But as somebody, I think as Trita pointed out, that's a general problem here, is that Israel's air defenses mean that if Iran wants to be confident of doing major damage to a target, it's probably got to rain a lot of ballistic missiles down. And then if a whole lot of them get through, it may do more damage than it really wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I would still be a little surprised if they struck Israeli territory per se. I don't know. Well, with a return address. In other words, with something that definitely came from Iran. Now, if they have people in Israel who can do what Israel does to Iran, which is assassinate people in Iran, that's a different story. And then just not say anything and not take responsibility for it, but everybody would know who did it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it would be quite hard for them to have a calibrated retaliation for the reasons you just said. But yeah, that Trita Parsi article in Responsible Statecraft that you mentioned, another thing that he says in it is, he talks about this report in Iranian media that quotes this anonymous Arab diplomat who says that Iran told the U.S. it's kind of an ultimatum. They will attack Israel. They will retaliate unless the U.S. is able to secure a ceasefire in Gaza. Right. And Trita Parsi seems to take this reporting seriously. I've seen some other people taking it seriously. The U.S. has denied it. Iran hasn't confirmed it. But apparently Iranian media sources have other media, more mainstream media, have been talking about it. And that would be a way for Iran to avoid, participating in this escalatory spiral. Parsi thinks it shows that they don't want to get involved in a war, but they need to do something not to lose face. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's worth noting, Bill Burns was in Cairo for these ceasefire talks, and apparently he did float a proposal that was supposed to be kind of a bridging proposal between the two sides. And Hamas had a delegation there, Israel had a delegation there. Usually it's not like fully attended, these ceasefire talks. Mm-hmm. So maybe that, possibly that was the Biden administration actually trying to do this. And of course, they don't want to seem like they're acting under pressure from Iran. So they're not going to announce this if it is true.
No, they're not going to acknowledge that if Iran gave them some ultimatum like that. The other thing Trita says is maybe Iran didn't give them the ultimatum, but is getting the word out there that they did because they think a ceasefire may happen. And then Iran can use that as a reason that they either don't retaliate at all and say, this is what we got, or they can use it as an excuse for a weaker retaliation than might otherwise seem necessary. I don't know. But, you know, it's, oh, man, the game theory is pretty complicated. I mean, you know, Biden could say, look, we're actually not to Israel. You know, we're actually not going to step in and help you because you got yourself into this mess. So get, unless you agree to a ceasefire. And then if Iran still retaliates, we'll do it. Of course, the ceasefire, you know, negotiations are themselves complicated and ongoing. And it's not like, I mean, I don't know what the status is in terms of what kind of offers are on the table from both sides, but. So, yeah, we'll see. I'm betting against an attack on Israeli soil that has an Iranian return address, like missiles coming from Iran. But we'll see. Gaza, possibly, if that's possible. I mean, logistically, but I don't know.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I do think Iran has to do something. So I think there's a chance of an attack on Israel, but I think I agree with you. And we can either move on to a totally different topic, or if we want to stick with Israel stuff, we can talk about this World Central Kitchen kind of update.
Oh, yeah. That is that's an interesting story. I saw that last night and sent it to you. And I was wondering, like, would it get so much attention that there was no point in our putting it in the newsletter? I don't think it has gotten quite that much. It seems to me very significant. The idea is that I gather of the two guys that Israel has disciplined who are involved in authorizing the strike, this was the senior officer who had to approve the strike that turned out to be on the food aid workers. And then what exactly is in his past?
So in January, he signed this open letter signed by other Israeli military people calling for the Israeli military to restrict aid into Gaza, restrict the flow of aid into Gaza, and then also to impose a siege onto Gaza City, which would involve not letting any humanitarian supplies in there and not allowing the operation of hospitals. I think the letter did say that this would be in conjunction with like the possibility for civilians to continue evacuating. But in any case, some people are saying, including this British lawyer, apparently of some sort of big name British lawyer that the Telegraph talked to, people have been saying that it kind of indicates that he might have been the kind of person to do this on purpose, because the IDF investigation found that this was a grave mistake, as they put it, and it resulted from errors of judgment, but that no one was knowingly targeting aid workers. And the fact that this guy was supporting, but, you know, was so on record opposed to letting aid into Gaza and supporting a siege-like condition is kind of calling that into doubt in some people's minds. That's the story.
Yeah, now he's a settler. I gather he's one of these radical settlers in the West Bank. And
yeah,
I'm not sure. I don't know if it was the letter signed only by military people or was it also by just settlers? I don't know. Anyway, the guy's on record. And I would think, if nothing else, this is the kind, like if I were South Africa bringing this genocide case, I would add this to the pile of evidence if that's still possible, because the whole thing about genocide is it hinges on establishing intent. And that's why they're making a big deal of things that the Israeli defense minister said about we're cutting off their food and their water because they're animals. So I don't know. I think I would certainly bring that up if I were South Africa, because of course, you know, denying them of aid, I think by modern standards of you know, the modern conception of genocide, that would be part of it.
I also think, you know, there were some interesting lines in this Telegraph piece unrelated to this latest development. I mean, related to the whole situation. So, you know, when the thing first happened, also I think it was the same day as the embassy strike, right? They both happened on April 1st. You know, Israel's immediate response and the IDF's response in the subsequent days was kind of interesting to me, because they didn't say what states normally say in situations like this, which is, oh, we thought it was an enemy caravan. You know, we thought those were Hamas vehicles. What they said was they thought that there was a militant in the vehicles. And apparently that was because they saw that there was an armed man entering the vehicles. And this telegraph.
But I think, did he turn out to be armed? They thought he was armed.
Right. It turns out he wasn't even armed.
Right.
And the telegraph said that they couldn't verify why anyone might have thought he was. I guess we just assume if they're telling the truth that they saw a nighttime recording and he was holding something that they thought was a gun. But
yeah, they're famous. I mean, there was the video of, I think, the U.S., I think, in Iraq, where they killed a Reuters photographer or something. Mm-hmm. And you could see the video and you could see that, like, if your job is to, like, if you're like, if you want to be alert to terrorists and find, and you're just looking for evidence that somebody's holding a gun and you're in that frame of mind, well, there's a lot of things you can see that look like a gun, but.
Mm. Yeah, I think that was Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks.
That could be, yeah. Yeah. So how long have we been?
It's time to go to overtime.
I think it's time to go to overtime. So. Yeah. The rest of this very worthwhile conversation, I think you'll join me in that judgment.
I totally agree.
Very worthwhile conversation is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Once you become one of those, you can just set up your special podcast feed, and then all of the overtime segments, which most Non-Zero podcasts have, will be automatically available to you. And the way you do that, I mean, the first thing you do if you become paid subscribers, if you just want to listen to the rest of this, you can just go to the post at the Non-Zero newsletter on Substack that is the post for this, and then you'll be able to get in and listen. But also there's a thing you click to set up your feed. Right. And if you don't want to do that, you can just smash the like button and rate and review us. Although you might, I don't know, you might be resenting the fact that you're being excluded from the rest of this podcast and not do that. Is that a danger?
That is a danger. Yeah.
Did I have not brought that up? Did I have not planted that thought in their minds?
It's okay. We can say
it is in order.
They can also go to the new Non-Zero Clips channel, because we have clips sometimes from overtime segments, so they can still see some of the overtime.
So, So on YouTube, you can either search for Non-Zero and get the main channel or Non-Zero Clips.
That's right. But yeah, we're going to talk about buttons. So we'll talk about Mark Andreessen, techno-optimism, U.S.-China relations, and artificial intelligence.
Also, I mean, I'm going to complain a little about this headline in the New York Times. This is the lead story, a couple days ago. Iran is flooding the West Bank with weapons. And, I mean, interesting time to put the headline out there. This is yesterday. At the moment where everyone is, you know, wondering whether America will get in a fight with Iran should it come to it. I'm not saying they're doing it because of that. I'm saying it's a time when probably you should be careful about whether such headlines are or are not justified by the story itself. Mm-hmm. And this is something I will address in overtime.
Looking forward to it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So thanks, everybody. And we will see some of you in overtime.
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.